And you're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM. And the following program represents the opinions of producers and participants and does not represent the views of WMRW LP or its license holder Roots Work or MRV TV. So our guest tonight will be Sean Dunnigan. He's a former DEA Senior Intelligence Research Specialist. And his bio states, from 1998 to 2011, Sean Dunnigan served as an intelligence research specialist for the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. Over the course of his career within the DEA, he participated in dozens of federal drug investigations during tours of duty in Florida, Pennsylvania, as well as internationally in Mexico and Guatemala. From a law enforcement family where his father was the town police chief, Sean always knew he wanted to go into public service and in to make a positive contribution to people's lives. Within his first few years with the DEA, however, he began to doubt the efficiency of the drug war. It was during his time in Guatemala that he truly started to understand the grave effects of prohibition. Sean explains, "I saw that Guatemala was very poor, with an abysmal educational system, high infant mortality, malnutrition, poor health care, and very underdeveloped national infrastructure. Yet the government, at U.S. insistence, directed much of its resources to fighting drug traffickers. The people there suffered twofold. Precious government resources are squandered fighting the drug war, and the only tangible results of those expenditures are higher crime and law enforcement that can't do its job. This is occurring all over the globe." One case that sticks in Sean's mind was a 1995 murder in which three people were murdered. While assisting with trial preparation, Sean learned that one small-time crack cocaine dealer had gotten into a dispute with a rival. Two of the dealer's associates ambushed the rival dealer as he drove into their apartment complex with his girlfriend and her 5-year-old son. All three were killed. "My son was 4 at the time," Sean says. Going through forensic photos from the case, it stuck with me that the violence which prohibition causes is real, just as with alcohol prohibition, drug prohibition artificially inflates profit margins for the banned substance and simultaneously removes any legal and peaceful means of dispute resolution. Sean holds a BA in philosophy and religion from Flagler College and a Master of Public Administration from Valdosta State University. He lives with his wife and 4 children in Washington, D.C., and works at a government accountability organization. So anyway, so this ongoing drug war that we have, and it seems like people in Mexico are getting a little upset again. And we'll have to see what he has to say, so stay tuned. All right, Sean, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So we are here with our guest, Sean Dunnigan, former DEA Senior Intelligent Research Specialist. So I guess to start, if you could tell us what a DEA Senior Intelligence Research Specialist does.
Hello?
Hello. You still got me?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing. I apologize.
Okay. How is it now?
That's better. Thank you.
Okay. So the question is, so what does a DEA Senior Intelligent Research Specialist do?
Sure. Well, basically, you know, the intelligence division is fairly large with several hundred analysts, intelligence analysts in DEA. And our work is kind of split between strategic intelligence, which is looking at kind of the big picture, looking at, you know, organizational profiles, drug flow trends, country profiles, that sort of thing. And tactical operational intelligence, which is providing direct support to investigations. And that includes participating in debriefings of informants and cooperating defendants and documenting those interviews, doing telephone toll analysis, wiretaps, that sort of thing. So in the course of my career, I was with them for about 13 years. In the course of my career, I got to do some of both. I got to do some strategic writing, briefings, larger kind of policy issue sort of stuff, and also some direct case support.
Very good. So is there anything that you would especially like to talk about tonight?
Sure. Well, I was, you know, after in the course of my 13-year career, I really became increasingly disillusioned with our national drug policy. Kind of in the course of those years, I gradually came to see it as a strategy that just wasn't working. You know, the problem wasn't getting any better. We were spending more and more money and arresting more and more people and having a bigger and bigger footprint in countries around the world. And the by any metric, the problem just didn't improve. The problem just kept getting worse. You know, drug use goes up, but more importantly, violence associated with the drug use continues to go up, not only in the U.S., but particularly in Mexico, but also in other places around the world. So I really came out of that experience, and I just left earlier this year, but I really came out of that experience in stark disagreement to our approach to drugs as a nation. Our whole national policy, I think, is misguided and in a lot of ways dangerous, and certainly, at the very least, wholly ineffective. So now I'm out of DEA for the past few months, and I'm a speaker with LEAP. It's an organization, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. That's made up of about 40,000 members altogether, many retired and former law enforcement officers, federal agents, judges, prosecutors, politicians, that sort of thing, who have had some kind of experience in the drug war and have kind of come out on the other side and really come to the same conclusion that our drug policies are misguided and really need to be reconsidered.
Could you tell us what is the official strategy for the U.S. as far as the drug war? What is their policies and how is it all set up and framed as far as what our mission is and how we're going to accomplish it?
Sure. You know, I apologize. I just caught the last part of your question. Is it regarding kind of our general strategy in the drug war?
Right. The official policy of the United States, the strategy that it takes and how it determines that strategy and how it implements it. I guess the whole aspect of how it works, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, DEA was founded in 1973, which is kind of by Richard Nixon, and that's kind of the start date for the war on drugs, so to speak. There was some legislation, some enforcement prior to that, but it really kicked off in earnest in 1973. And since then, our strategy has basically been unchanged. We've really, our strategy is very heavily focused on enforcement and on interdiction, basically stopping drug shipments from coming into the country through law enforcement means, discouraging drug production and cultivation in the U.S., and arresting people who use drugs. And that strategy, if there's been a shift over the past several decades, that's the only shift really been from focusing not only on producers, major producers, suppliers, dealers, to a focus on end users, on individual drug users. And that really accounts for most of our strategy. If you look at the Office of National Drug Control budget, the Drug Czar's office, their budget, their annual budget, is about $26, $27 million a year, and that's about 60, 65% focused on interdiction and enforcement, and the rest on treatment and prevention. And that's just the ONDCP budget. The DEA's budget is about $2.6 billion a year, and that's, of course, almost entirely enforcement-oriented. So that's really been our strategy. Our strategy has been to try to police our way out of this problem. And kind of what I've come to believe over my experience with DEA is that that's not the way to do it. It doesn't work. If you look at the only substance that we've really been successful at reducing the use of is tobacco. Half as many people smoke cigarettes now as did 20 years ago. And at the same time, if you believe the government's own surveys, twice as many 12th graders smoke marijuana as did 20 years ago. So, we know what works from looking at other substances. Treatment, education, prevention, those sorts of things really do work and are effective at reducing drug use. And enforcement, this whole strategy that we've built around locking people up and putting them in jail just doesn't work. I mean, it's been demonstrably ineffective. But unfortunately, that has been the cornerstone of our policy, and that's continued to be the cornerstone of our policy across administration. It's really been unchanged. Regardless of whether Democrats or Republicans are in office and what the makeup of Congress is, we've maintained this very strong focus on enforcement and interdiction.
So what was the specific event that made you question the strategy of the United States and what we were doing?
Boy, it's hard to say. I can't say that there was an epiphany moment, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, it was gradual, and it was just seeing a lot of effort going into this that yielded no results to speak of. There were individual things. I was in Guatemala from 2001 to 2004, and that was kind of an eye-opener. Prior to that, I had been in Miami doing the strategic kind of work that I spoke about earlier. But in Guatemala, I kind of saw more of the front lines, and Guatemala is just a horribly poor country. It's the second poorest country in the hemisphere. About 60% of the population lives in poverty, or they say that while I live there. And I saw, the U.S. stance. You're spending millions of dollars to fight drugs in Guatemala, and more than that, kind of bullying the Guatemalan government into spending millions of dollars into fighting our drug war there. In a country that had, very poor infrastructure, very poor educational system, tremendous human poverty. I mean, it's one of the few places in the hemisphere where people do starve. So kind of seeing that, it was really misguided priorities and thinking, this is not the best use of resources in this country. So that contrast. And then certainly most recently, I was in Mexico. I was in Monterrey, Mexico for 2 years at the very end of my career. And just seeing the escalation of violence in Mexico and just how all of this, all of the killings, about 12,000 or so drug-related murders in Mexico last year, more than 100 of American citizens, incidentally, last year, and seeing this problem really escalate in Mexico. I mean, and it's all prohibition-related. It's not use-related. It's not because people are using drugs. It's because our policies have turned over a multi-billion-dollar industry to violent criminal gangs. So, of course, just like prohibition, right, which was gave birth to Al Capone and really the mob culture in our country.
Exactly.
We've created that. We've created that in Mexico. So that, it was kind of both sides. Seeing that it doesn't work, the inefficiency. Seeing the waste, in the case of Guatemala, seeing the waste of resources that were badly needed in other areas of public policy. And then in Mexico, really seeing the destructive side of it, seeing just how much harm is done by prohibitionist policies.
So what kind of case were you working on in Guatemala? Like, what was happening? What were you sent there for?
Yeah, Guatemala, just because its geographic location is a transshipment point. About 85-90% of the cocaine that comes from Colombia en route to the United States comes through Central America, obviously because that's where Central America is. So we find it's kind of Guatemala's role in the drug flow is as a transshipment point, as a warehouse point for drug shipments going to the U.S. So the cases we worked were primarily against traffickers that were really intermediaries, brokers, you know, people who were coordinating drug loads primarily coming in from Colombia to Guatemala, staged there, and being sent on to the U.S. Because the infrastructure is so poor there, the law enforcement and judicial infrastructure are so poor, Guatemala was really an easy target for drug traffickers. And drugs would be brought in on go-fast boats, fishing vessels, airplanes. At the time I was there, there were about 500 or so clandestine airstrips in northern Guatemala where planes with ton quantities of cocaine would come in and land and unload their cargo, and there was really no law enforcement response to that that Guatemala could mount. So the cases we worked were primarily that type, you know, looking at Guatemalan traffickers and then trying to expand those cases northward primarily, trying to see U.S. indictments for Guatemalan traffickers and southward into Colombia. But it's certainly an interesting country, and the drug trafficking dynamic there, just because it is so poor and corruption is such a problem, not only in Guatemala but in Mexico as well. It really had a dramatic impact on society there. I mean, worldwide drug trafficking is, estimates are all over, but the UN says a $400 billion a year industry. The U.S. drug market is at least $65 billion, anybody's best guess, which is almost the entire GDP of Guatemala. There's so much money involved, and it's really concentrated in the hands of a relatively small number of traffickers, that their ability to penetrate and corrupt law enforcement, judicial, and political systems in the country were tremendous. So we did a fair number of public corruption cases as well, public officials that have been arrested. Just in the past few years, the head of the drug czar, so to speak, the head of Guatemala's National Drug Police, was arrested for conspiring with traffickers. While I was there, I think this was in 2003, they actually disbanded the country's federal anti-narcotics police, called the DOAN was the name of the unit, because eight of the officers stole 1,600 pieces of cocaine from their evidence locker and sold it back to the traffickers. So we got involved in that as well, working with, to the extent possible, host nation counterparts, but then often, looking at them as targets and investigating them as well.
So how many people would you say that you had brought to trial while you were down there? I guess corrupt officials and traffickers. Were you able to prosecute or not?
It's
an ongoing thing. I know.
Relatively small number.
Mm-hmm.
I'll certainly say that. We work on just the DEA's mission. Is to try to work on the highest levels of traffickers, certainly. In foreign arena, that's kind of what we do. And that really is because of the legal authority under which we operate in the international environment. There is extraterritorial authority granted to U.S. law enforcement in Title 21, U.S. Code Title 21, just the drug law. Any trafficker or producer, facilitator, that send shipments to the United States can be prosecuted in the United States, regardless of whether they ever set foot in U.S. soil. Oh. So we have kind of a very broad venue legally to go after, indict, ultimately prosecute traffickers at a high enough level that their shipments are directly going to the United States. So those are the kind of people we worked on. In terms of how many significant arrests while I was there, certainly fewer than a dozen during my 4 years there, 3 years there.
Now, were they big traffickers or more of a small time, could you say?
Well, they were, they were big traffickers, certainly. The problem is, one of the inherent mistakes in our drug policy is, this idea that if we take out the kingpins, right, the drug lords, that those are going to be more significant investigations. So, the people we targeted and certainly the people that were arrested because of DEA efforts during my time in Guatemala, were big. I mean, they were moving a lot of drugs and responsible for a lot of violence. But, the myth is that arresting those people and prosecuting those people is going to have some kind of substantive impact on on drug flow, right? The idea of doing this ultimately is to restrict the flow of cocaine and heroin and marijuana into the United States with the idea that it's going to be harder to get, which is going to discourage use. But it just doesn't work that way because, you know, no matter how high somebody is on that food chain, you know, the largest traffickers in the world get arrested and or killed, and they're replaced just as easily as a street-level drug dealer. Now, there are always people willing to take that risk to make millions of dollars a year for by coordinating drug loads. So, yeah, I mean, they were significant traffickers in the sense that they had done a lot and were big players in that world, but they were just as easily replaced as anyone else in that environment or in that food chain. You know, and if you look at what's happened recently in Mexico, several, you know, what we would consider really top echelon traffickers have been killed or arrested. Arturo Beltran Leyva, who was one of the biggest traffickers in the country, was killed several months ago. Well, you know, okay, he was a big target. He did a lot. He was a bad guy, but just because he's out of the equation, out of the drug trafficking world, there isn't any less cocaine or any less heroin coming into the United States. So, yes, they were big. Yes, they were important. But whether any of those efforts were really impactful in the broader sense, I would say no. If anything, you know, just when you take out people at that level or even at the intermediate level, it invites conflict. It invites conflict between cartels and sects within the cartels to fight for that position and to fight for the routes that had previously had been controlled by that person. So, you know, it really is. It's just like arresting somebody who controls a street corner. Well, what's going to happen when you arrest somebody who controls one street corner? There's going to be a fight among all the people that control the neighboring street corners to try to expand their territory. So that dynamic happens at every level. And again, that is a function of prohibition. We've just turned this industry over to violent organizations, and that's the way that contracts are going to be made, territory is going to be established, and disputes are going to be resolved is through violence. So, yes, the long answer to a short question, I know, but yes, they were big traffickers, but whether there was any long-term impact to that, I would certainly have to say not.
Well, I mean, that seems to be the big problem. I mean, it's like the U.S. policy hasn't changed, hasn't learned from its past mistakes, hasn't learned from prohibition of alcohol, and it seems like just this vicious circle. It's going over and over again, and I don't understand why the U.S. keeps doing the same policy over and over. I mean, they're afraid to change course, I guess. I mean, have they ever thought of different alternatives to the way they're doing it, or they just figure eventually this is going to work? Or, I mean, do they really care about it? It seems like it's almost lip service because what's being done isn't effective. It hasn't proven to be effective yet. You know, and a lot of people, innocent people, are dying as a consequence. And as you say in Guatemala, I mean, forcing the government to spend money on this creates more problems for the people. You know, so I'm thinking in Guatemala, so if their government didn't have to spend money on this drug war and they didn't get involved with the U.S. in it, do you think the average Guatemalan would even feel any effect of the traffickers or anything? I mean, I guess it would be good for the economy, maybe in a sense, but do you think that they would notice any drug problem or anything?
No, I think it would be really, be beneficial for say, Guatemalans, Central Americans, generally Mexicans and Americans, to end the policy. The policy has done is divert precious resources to combat drug trafficking. It's diverted law enforcement resources and priorities away from violent crimes, really, and toward drug trafficking. And it's created an environment where their government is really held hostage. Their government is captive to criminal organizations. So it's been horrible for the rule of law across the board. It's been detrimental to other public policies, public policy concerns, because there is just, you know, the pie is only so big, and there's just necessarily fewer resources available for schools and roads and bridges and things that really do matter. And it's also negatively impacted those countries because the level of violence that the prohibition has caused discourages foreign investment. You know, American companies are starting to pull out of northern Mexico, for instance, exactly because of that, because the level of violence is so high. So it impacts them more broadly in that sense as well. And you know, that's not to mention the level of street violence. You know, what you have when you have police agencies that are, you know, in the pockets of drug traffickers is, you know, you really don't have police agencies that are patrolling the streets. You know, Mexico has thousands of police officers, but you know, if you get robbed down there, or you know, in a car accident or something, you're not going to call a cop, no matter how many of them there may be,
yes.
Because they're not there to respond to that sort of thing. So I think, you know, rethinking this policy, getting away from the prohibition model, we really just have a lot of benefits in a lot of ways for average Guatemalans, Mexicans, and of course Americans as well.
Right. I mean, and at this time, the Mexicans are starting to protest the drug war and saying it's not effective. And I mean, I'm hearing numbers that are saying like 35,000 plus minus have died directly related to the drug war. And I would guess that would be getting old after a while. So what were you doing in Mexico? What was your job and what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, it was really similar to what I was doing in Guatemala.
It's basically trafficking.
Traffickers. And then, of course, the situation there was very much in flux and very much on the radar of U.S. policymakers. So a fair amount of what I did was just keeping track of who the players were, the organizations, and then informing the Washington ambassador and that sort of thing about the situation. You know, to your earlier point, it is absolutely correct. The average Mexican perceives the drug, I think it's safe to say the average Mexican perceives drug violence as a function of bad U.S. policy without question. There's certainly a growing voice to call for legalization or at least, you know, de-escalation of the drug war. And just a couple of weeks ago, Vicente Fox, former Mexican president, came out and called for legalization. So that debate is really ramping up in Mexico because of the ill effects they've experienced because of our policy. And really, I can understand that perspective. You know, Mexicans don't care how much cocaine goes into the United States any more than we would care if all the cocaine coming into the U.S. were ultimately ending up in Canada. We wouldn't be fighting this war. That's kind of their perspective. You know, is that it's a U.S. problem. It's fueled by U.S. demand, and the negative consequences are really engendered by bad U.S. policy. So, you know, why should they be losing, as you mentioned, 35,000 or so citizens to drug violence since President Calderon took office? And the number of people killed every year just continues to go up. So the problem's getting worse. I do think it's kind of a growing movement in Mexico in favor of legalization. The problem is, you know, the U.S. kind of forced, to a large extent, other countries in the hemisphere into U.N. conventions, the Geneva Convention, and other international conventions on drug use that really kind of compels them to follow the U.S. model and kind of hamstrings them and limits what they can do to change their policy. They would be violating. Technically, if Mexico were to say, okay, drugs are legal as of today, they would be violating international accords they've made previously. So it's not to say that they shouldn't do it, but it's, you know, we've certainly made it as difficult for them as possible.
Right. Well, I mean, to me, there is a corruption issue, but then I guess there also is the business issue because the United States keeps building prisons. I mean, what is it? 25% of the population or something is in jail or something to that effect. And it's a big money-making effort. And also with different police departments, they get money if they'll do busts and stuff like that and increases revenue. Do you think that's possibly one of the problems with this drug war is that, I mean, people are making money illegally and legally on it. And that's why the policy doesn't seem to change because I would figure this policy has been effective, you know, I'd say over 30 years, I guess, for now, and it doesn't work. And I think everyone realizes it doesn't work, and we keep hoping that it's going to work. But do you think there's some element of business involved in the drug war?
Well, I think, you know, specifically if you look at asset forfeiture, you know, it's very, very easy, much easier than I think most people realize, for law enforcement to seize money, property, vehicles from people just on the really little more than the suspicion that that those are proceeds from drug trafficking. So I think it has, you know, I think it's kind of incentivized for law enforcement. It's incentivized making asset seizures rather than investigating actual crime. So yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly true. In terms of why the policy hasn't been changed, you know, it's I think there's a couple things at play. I think one is just inertia. You know, there's always there's always a tendency not to change, and that's certainly
right.
True in this case. You know, that's how it's been. Now we have a whole generation that was kind of raised on DARE, and you know, have heard the government propaganda their entire life. So there's kind of this instilled resistance to change, regardless of you know, what the facts are, how demonstrably failed the policy is. I also think, you know, it's very hard, and one thing that LEAP tries to do, you know, is to bring the drug war issue kind of closer and more on the radar for most people. You know, it's an issue that many people care about. But for most people, you know, most people that are running their congressmen, it's not their primary concern. You know, it's a secondary or tertiary concern. And so I think part of the reason is just it's not an issue that most people spend enough time reading about, thinking about, analyzing, and really looking at and considering the policy alternatives that do exist. So, you know, I think that's kind of the problem, you know. But that is changing. I mean, if you look at public polling, you know,
right.
The last national public poll about marijuana legalization, it came in at 45% support for legalization, which is the highest it's been. And if you look over the decades, it's been really steadily increasing. So I'm hopeful that there's, you know, there's going to be this confluence of factors, you know, that people looking at the violence in Mexico are going to understand that that's a result of prohibition. That people looking at kind of the budgetary implications of prohibition, you know, we've spent $1 trillion fighting the drug war and we have nothing to show for it. So there's that factor. And then, as you mentioned, there's the increasing incarceration rate. You know, we have more people in prison and jail than China or Russia
mm-hmm.
do, but by a long shot. We incarcerate more people than any country in the world. So it's meaningless. You know, we spend a lot of money. We don't get anything for it. It fuels violence, and you know, as more and more people kind of look at the issue, I would hope that ultimately there'll be some pressure to make a policy change. I think I really do believe, you know, LEAP is an educational organization, and I really do believe that increased education about the issue will result in changed public attitudes and ultimately changed public policy.
So we're talking with our guest, Sean Dunnigan, a former DEA senior intelligence research specialist. So is there a specific, how am I going to say this? Was there a specific moment that made you decide to join LEAP, or had you heard about it, or how did you get involved with LEAP?
Yeah, you know, I had heard about it. I honestly don't recall how I heard about it. I'm sure it was poking around on the web. We have pretty robust website, copssaylegalizeddrugs.com, the website. Probably just from poking around on the web and reading what they'd done. And then I joined as a member a number of years ago. But then after I left DEA earlier this year, I signed on with LEAP to be a speaker for them and to do some work for them. So, you know, it's a great organization, and I think just if you look at the Speakers Bureau, you know, the people that we have, I mean, federal judges, federal agents, very experienced law enforcement management from some big cities. You know, it's people that spent their life looking at this issue and come to this conclusion. You know, I think part of the reason that there's been resistance to change as well is that the prohibitionists, you know, the drug czar's office, that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing, you know, they always try to make a joke of drug legalization and portray those who are advocating for a change in policy as, you know, just a bunch of crazed, you know, 18-year-old donors that that just want to get hot. So I think that LEAP really brings a very rational voice to the debate and a unique perspective to the debate. You know, they can't be characterized that way. It just isn't true. You know, these are people that really care about the issue, that care about good law enforcement practices and see how bad the drug war has been for law enforcement and really for public safety and the rule of law in the country. So, LEAP's a great organization. I was very, very happy to come over and do some speaking on their behalf after leaving DEA.
So what originally made you decide to join the DEA out of all the law enforcement agencies?
Well, you know, when I joined, I obviously didn't have this opinion, this perspective.
Right.
Why I joined, I'd always kind of been interested in law enforcement. My father was a police chief. My brother's a police detective. So it's something that I was certainly interested in. And, you know, like most people, I hadn't really looked critically at the drug war, at policies, or what the EA is doing around the world. You know, I just kind of thought, okay, well, you know, the drugs are bad. People who do drugs must be bad. Working for DEA must be honorable work. And so I was, I joined them back in 1998. It was, you know, really a gradual progression over the course of those years that changed my mind. And, mm-hmm. and after those years, I kind of thought, wow, this was wasted time. This was nothing good has been accomplished because of my efforts or the efforts of really anyone else working in the drug war. Now, not to say they're bad people. I still have friends in the agency and
right.
respect them, but it's bad policy.
So do you have a feeling that you tried to accomplish something but have the sense that nothing's really changed since you were in the DEA? Or do you feel little bits have changed? Or do you feel that people are actually awakening to the concept that prohibition doesn't work and they're actually relating it to the alcohol prohibition? Or do you think most agents and officials don't even put the two together?
You know, I think, honestly, I think most probably don't. I think what happens is, you know, the people that DEA targets, the majority of people that DEA targets, there are certainly exceptions, but, you know, most of the people that DEA targets are bad guys. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're violent criminals. They've killed people. They kidnap and that sort of thing. So I think there's a narrow focus on the part of most folks at DEA looking at targeting these specific individuals because of these specific deeds. But, you know, the reality is the reason that those specific deeds are being committed is because of this broader scheme of prohibition that we have in place. So I think most probably just don't think about it. You know, they look at the kind of the consequence of prohibition and think that that's what has to be combated. Well, they're right. You know, the consequences of prohibition, you know, increased violence, disease, and death, and a civil war on our border. Yes, those do need to be combated. But the way we've been going about it for so many years has just proven itself to be ineffective. So I think that's I think that's probably the error in their judgment. I would say it's just not looking at the kind of the cause of those effects that they're trying to combat. You know, the problem is not cocaine. The problem is not heroin. The problem is not marijuana. The problem is that our approach to it has necessitated violence in its production and transportation and use. You know, that we don't see in alcohol or tobacco or, you know, legal drugs. So I think that's the problem with how a lot of people that are, you know, fighting the war, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
perceive it. I do think that public attitude, both in and out of law enforcement, is probably changing. The longer it goes on, particularly I think the longer it goes on and the worse things get in Mexico, is really going to force more and more people to reevaluate the policy and think about what we're doing, because that's what's missing. You know, nobody's really thinking about what we're doing. I'm hopeful that LEAP is able to make that point, to kind of present alternative policies for how to address this problem in ways that reduce the level of violence and other, you know, disease and overdose death and that sort of thing that right now is a part of drug trafficking.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Most people don't think about it. I mean, the general public, I mean, they hear about it on the radio and TV, but they really, it doesn't hit home until it directly affects them. So therefore, they don't even, I don't even think they want to be informed on what the policies are and how it works. And like a lot of times we hear about the gangs in Mexico and they're like the big evil and all that stuff. Yet we've had gangs in the United States probably before we were a country. I mean, New York City alone in the 1800s was insane, filled with gangs. Those gangs would still be there, I would imagine, different forms and stuff. But what is the DEA doing as far as dealing with the homegrown, which isn't necessarily homegrown because, I mean, it's an international smorgasbord here in the United States. You got gangs from all over the world, yet they're in the United States. Some are citizens, some are not. But how are we dealing with our problems at home? Because it tends that we tend to go overseas or to other countries to deal with our problems, I guess trying to nip it in the butt, so to speak. But it doesn't seem like we deal with the issues at home. We never hear about it too often on the news about gangs and what the U.S. is doing with that. I mean, you hear about investigations and stuff, but, I mean, what actually gets done? Is that something you can address?
Yeah, well, you know, DEA, most DEA agents are based in the U.S., addressing you know, domestically based traffickers and domestically based trafficking organizations, including gangs. You know, most of that work, or a lot of that work, is done in partnership with state and local law enforcement agencies. So we try to, you know, pair up with them and provide whatever resources DEA can bring to the table, including an avenue for federal prosecution. To those officers and to those agencies. There's also, you know, there's some overlap there because, you know, Mexican trafficking organizations have really established some pretty extensive partnerships and working relationships with U.S. gangs, with U.S.-based gangs. It's all over the country. So it's kind of a distinction without a difference. You know, there are gangs in... Well, I don't know about Vermont, but there are certainly gangs in Boston and New York and Washington and Florida and Washington State, all over the country, that have direct ties with Mexican trafficking organizations. And again, you know, it's part of what we've created. You know, we've made sure that the only people involved in this industry are criminals. So who's going to fill the void? Well, criminals are going to fill the void. But yeah, DEA is active domestically. But again, you know, no matter how many people we arrest, you know, well over a million people a year on drug charges. Look, close to a million people a year just on marijuana charges. And
right.
Of those, roughly 80% or so on marijuana possession charges. You know, we can't arrest more people. You know, we don't have room in the prisons. Our criminal justice system, there's prosecution, courts, is completely saturated. This idea that we can, you know, just get out of this problem and solve it by arresting enough people is just doesn't work. I mean, it hasn't worked for a long time. But I think as the number of arrests go up and up and up, you know, I think people are seeing that. I hope that people are starting to see the futility of that approach.
Right. Would you say most of the people in prison are users or big-time drug dealer types?
No, I would certainly say most, you know, including federal, state, and county jails, local jails. Yeah, most are users. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt the vast majority of people arrested are arrested for using drugs and not for... not for selling, certainly not for selling them on any grand scale. But again, you know, just the economics of it, what we've done with prohibition is marginalize people who are drug users. You know, we said, okay, they've really been marginalized outside of the mainstream economy, of the legal economy. They can't work, they can't do anything, and prohibition artificially inflated prices for drugs incredibly, you know. Under alcohol prohibition, the price of beer went up several hundred percent. Well, the same thing is in play with drug prohibition. So, you know, we have people who are addicted, right? addicted to a substance that's artificially expensive, and they're really marginalized out of the legal economy, so they have means of making a legal living. That's where most small-time dealers come from.
Right, right.
Not kids who grow up thinking, boy, I'm really going to make my millions selling drugs on the street corner. Most come from addiction. And then, of course, the parallel to that is we focus so heavily on arresting these people that the resources for treatment for people who do want it just simply aren't there.
Yeah, non-existent.
There's always enough beds in prison, but there are never enough beds in treatment facilities. So, we have people with this, what really is a medical condition. Being addicted to substance is a medical problem, but we don't treat it as a medical problem. We don't provide, for the most part, we don't provide avenues for them to receive the medical help they really would need. So we create dealers, we create pushers, and we create burglars and armed robbers, car thieves, and that sort of thing, just because of the prohibitionist scheme that increases prices so artificially and makes violence an intrinsic part of the drug world.
Well, and creates the addiction, because during Prohibition, alcoholism was through the roof, as I understand it, and then once Prohibition went down, there's always going to be alcoholics, but it wasn't to the extreme it was. It's sort of like underage drinking. I mean, the age used to be 18 in this state, then they drove it to 21. So when the young drinker drinks, they don't know when they're going to get to drink again, or drugs. I guess it's all the same. So they're going to drink until they get sick, or maybe kill themselves or kill someone else because it's not available. So with the drug war, the same issue. It's not available. It's illegal. You don't know when you're going to get it. So I think it tends to make people more crazy over it. Oppose that, if I can go to the store and get it, it's no big deal. Again, there's always going to be people that are going to abuse it. But I think with legalization, I mean, originally I think maybe rates would go up, but I think it would bottom out. It would not be a big deal. To me, again, using the forbidden fruit idea, it's like, ooh, this is something I can't have, so therefore I'm going to be a bad boy and do it. And with the Swiss model, with the heroin, I mean, I guess they have clinics where you can go and basically shoot up every day, so you're not going to overdo it. You know what kind of drug you're getting. It's not cut with whatever. There's a specific thing how it's set up, and it's much safer for everyone involved, to where, some of the people that I've seen in that program, basically they don't have that urge to just totally go crazy with it. They use what they're going to use to maintain themselves. And I guess that's what I see the major problem with the prohibition is, that it is creating the addiction problem in the first place. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. There's no question. You're right. The kind of forbidden fruit theory, right? It happens with teen drinking, and it certainly happens with drug use. I mean, more American teenagers smoke pot than teenagers in the Netherlands.
Right. Basically, exactly.
They'll walk into a coffee shop and do it, or have somebody buy it. And why is that? Well, it's just the allure is gone.
Yes.
With regard to harder drugs, I would say, I don't know anybody, or I'm pretty confident I don't know anybody, that if heroin were legal tomorrow, they would, walk down to the drugstore and buy heroin just to try it. That's not the way, just epidemiologically speaking, that's not how it works.
Right.
So prohibition, has created that allure and the allure of the drug culture. And you're right, absolutely right about alcohol prohibition. Within 2 years after prohibition, more people were drinking, and a lot more people were suffering ill effects because, you didn't know what purity you were drinking, right? There were all mm-hmm. kinds of, there were no quality controls, certainly, in what was being produced. So, the repeal of alcohol prohibition came about because of public health concerns. It was because it was pretty clear that it was better public policy and a lot safer and a lot less harmful to have alcohol legal than to have it illegal. And certainly the same thing is true of illicit drugs today. If you buy a bag of heroin on the street, there's God knows what's in it. There are dozens of different cutting agents that are used. Purity ranges from pretty close to 0% to pretty close to 90%. Imagine, if you went to a liquor store and you bought a bottle of liquor, and it could be, 2 proof or
right,
198 proof, and you had no way of knowing. That's really the situation right now that exists in the illegal drug world. So it's very dangerous. The vast majority of overdose deaths are because of that, are directly attributable to that, to the lack of any kind of controls on what people are injecting. And again, also the lack of access to treatment programs.
Right. I don't know. To me, it's like the policies are trying to promote morals, which to me, it just doesn't seem like that's a possible thing to do. People are going to do what they're going to do regardless. So to me, I guess, tend to make it a safe environment and a legal environment, and I would think you'd have less problems. I mean, it's the same with prostitution. It's something that's been around forever. Nobody wants to admit that it exists. The people that do it usually aren't doing too good, and they can also be addicted to different substances and being abused and stuff like that. Because, again, it's something that you don't want to regulate because it's an evil or it's a bad thing and you shouldn't get involved in it, so you try to hide from the problem and, you know, with the drug war and all that. I mean, to me, it's basically we're hiding from the problem. It's like we throw money at it, we arrest some people and go, oh, look at what we're doing, but it just doesn't solve the problem. And in this state, I guess they're talking about decriminalization. I'm not sure if they've done it or not, but still... Well, and then also when we had legalization for medical marijuana, now they're going to have dispensaries, but in the beginning, they're having people just going on the streets buying it, you know. So if you're doing marijuana for a medicinal purpose, what you get on the street, you don't know what it is. It's not, it could help you, it might not help you, or it might help you. And again, there's no regulation, there's nothing there in place to make it safe, you know, so our state legalizes it for them, yet says go out on the street and buy it. So then you're still supporting the gangs. You're still supporting, you know, all the different groups that are wrong, in my opinion, and shouldn't be allowed to do this. But at the same time, you're setting up the market so it is theirs, you know, because we don't want to get involved for moral reasons. And it just confuses me. I just can't see how the same policy stays in place. I mean, I can because, I mean, I guess I believe that people are making money on it, you know, legally, you know, through working law enforcement and doing all this stuff. And nobody wants to step out of line. That's why LEAP I always find very impressive, because these are people that say, wait a minute, I've done it, I've seen it, it's not working, you know. But then it seems nobody wants to listen to that, you know. And it's like, right, how do you get it through people's heads that there is an alternative to what we're doing? And how are we going to get there? So
yeah, it's you're right. That's the challenge, is kind of getting it through people's heads. Again, I mean, I do think that there's been movement. Well, there's certainly been movement in public opinion, if you put any faith at all in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there has been, you know, some movement in that sense. And also, you know, as you mentioned, what Vermont's doing and the number of states that are kind of moving toward decriminalization. Of course, you know, the proposition in California, Prop 19, failed, but it didn't fail by very much.
Right.
So I believe probably in the very near future there'll be a proposition like initiative that does pass in California, and of course other states will follow along. So I do think it's changing. It's slow.
It's,
you know,
a slow process.
And how you get through, how you affect that change is really one person at a time. A lot of what LEAP does is speaking to civic groups. You know, we talk to Rotaries and church groups and chambers of commerce and that sort of thing. And it's, you know, having this audience to which we can present the case, you know, the evidence for why this is a bad policy, why it should be changed, and what the benefits would be if it were changed. And I think, you know, at the end of those conversations, you can see there's certainly people's minds are changed, or at the very least, there's more of a willingness to look at the policies critically and to think about this issue. You mentioned earlier, you know, people have this idea that it doesn't affect them. And, you know, that's another thing that I think, though it's tragic, I think kind of works in our favor. You know, more and more people are being impacted. If
right.
you look at what was done with the Higher Education Act, that anybody arrested on drug charges was ineligible for federal financial aid. Well, you know, that impacted a lot of people that previously, you know, hadn't been impacted mm-hmm. by the war on drugs. So, you know, they see their kids for, you know, doing something that's not terribly egregious, you know, losing the eligibility for federal aid, and just the sheer numbers of people, you know, millions of people over the years that have been arrested for just use of marijuana or other drugs. that are impacted. So, you know, I think as more and more people are impacted by this bad policy, though it's unfortunate that that has to happen, certainly, mm-hmm. I think that's another factor that is likely to kind of lead more people to take a critical view. And I hope LEAP can be a part of that as we speak to these groups and kind of get people, get the issue on people's radar. In the past, it's been very easy for politicians to support prohibition, right? Mm-hmm. Because the status quo, the drug dealers are bad guys, and that's it. That's the end of the story. So we have to have this massive multi-billion-dollar law enforcement and military initiative to go after them. Well, that's not a valid argument. That's not
right.
The way it works. The way to go after the problem is to look at what policies would really limit the violence and alleviate the human suffering. I think it's changing. I do think it's changing. The earlier point you made about, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do, you know, I think that's absolutely true if you look at the data. What our drug policies have been, have had, or the numbers of seizures, for instance, and total amount seized or how many people are arrested has absolutely no impact whatsoever on drug use, the availability of drugs, the price of drugs, security of drugs. They're just completely unrelated data sets. A good example of that is what was done with crack cocaine sentencing for a long time. The federal sentencing guidelines for crack cocaine, and not just guidelines, but mandated sentencing for crack cocaine offenders was 10 times what it was for powder cocaine offenders. Well, you know, crack didn't go away as a result of that. When that was changed, you know, crack didn't just explode onto the market. You know, there's not that connect. So this argument that, that we can enforce our way and arrest our way and prosecute our way out of this problem, it's just not true. The data just doesn't support that in any sense. The factors that lead people to do drugs have nothing whatsoever to do with how hard we're fighting the drug war. Except that it makes it worse, as you mentioned, because mm-hmm. of the impurities and the violence that exists within the market and that sort of thing. But in terms of how many people are actually using, there's no matter how draconian we make our laws, it's not going to make the problem better. We really need to move in the opposite direction.
So what do you think the average person could do? What would you suggest, I guess, to get involved?
Well, as I mentioned, there's a lot of state-level initiatives. Most states right now have something floating around here in their state legislative committees or policy proposals that exist. So, you know, I would certainly encourage people to educate themselves about the issue. You know,
right.
That's kind of the foundational thing. People that don't take a critical look, just accept what the government's telling them about drug policy, they're really doing themselves a disservice. So I think the first thing is LEAP and other organizations that kind of work on drug policy and drug policy reform. Get to take an interest in the issue. Secondly, I would say to look at what initiatives are present in their state. Look at those proposals, you know, the medical marijuana decriminalization proposals, and really to let their voice be heard. Politicians aren't going to change the policy if they are of the opinion that everybody is behind that policy.
Right.
But if they start getting letters from concerned citizens, mothers, you name it, the other organizations, law enforcement people, you know, people kind of encouraging them to take a more critical look at drug policy and to support reform initiatives, well, that can have a real change. So. I think that's the most important thing that people can do. Certainly, you know, joining LEAP, we have 40,000 or so members right now.
Mm-hmm.
Great resources that you get when you join, and really a lot of information on the website. So those are the kinds of things that people can do, just to learn as much as they can about the issue, take an interest in it, take the time to look at what the policy alternatives are, and kind of push those policy alternative proposals with their local, state, and federal elected officials.
Very good. So do you have any final words? You pretty much summed it up there.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Excellent.
You mentioned what can we do to get this through people's heads. This is a tremendous part of it. Being on shows like yours that are willing to take the time and address the issue and have a conversation about it, I can't tell you how valuable that is. So just thank you very much for your time. I sincerely appreciate it. It's really a great venue.
Yeah, it seems to be that's one of the biggest problems. People are afraid to talk about it because if you talk about it, that's like you're supporting it, and that's not always the case, supporting it, you know, and that's people are afraid, okay, if I start talking about it, then people think I'm doing drugs, and then they get afraid of whatever.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I have, you know, people say, well, what about the kids? That's always the argument. Well, I have four children. I don't want any of them to use drugs. I don't support them using drugs, but any more than I want them to drink. But, you know, what we've done is not keeping drugs out of our children's hands. They're just as available as they've ever been. You know, 80% or so of high school seniors say that marijuana is available in their schools. 35% say cocaine is available.
Oh, yeah.
This myth that our drug war is protecting children from drugs is just demonstrably, unquestionably false.
Well, I know, and that's funny up here because we're a very small town. I mean, three or four towns, we have a population of 7,000, yet we have a heroin issue. We have federal marshals come through town every so often, you know, DEA, the whole nine yards. And it's something that's not just in the city. It's everywhere. And everyone will always think, well, it's not my child doing it, you know, and it's everywhere. And the policies definitely need to change. But then again, it's talking. And that's the simplest way that you can start changes, by talking. Just get over that fear and talk about it. Huh. All right. Well, thank you very much, Sean. It was a pleasure. And
thank you.
And keep up the good work, and have a great evening.
Great, thank you. Likewise, thank you very much.
All right. Have a good night. Okay. So there you go. Another conversation, the same old, same old. And if you will notice that, yes, the same things come up every time. It's funny how it works that way. Complicated problem, simple solutions, just say no. I don't think that worked, Nancy. And the problem will not go away. And we need to talk about it, and don't be afraid talking about it, because, you know, if you're thinking that people are going to think you're morally corrupt by talking about it, instead of turning your back on it, which turning your back on it doesn't work. And if you think that your child won't get messed up on it, alcohol or drugs of any kind, take a second guess. Think about it. And legalization, yes, they might still do those drugs, but will they do them to the extreme that they would do it as when it's illegal? That binge drinking thing, you know. Well, if we raise the age to 21, we won't have a problem till later on. It doesn't work that way. Be honest with yourself. Look at how you were when you were a child. And I know there were some perfect little angels out there, but the majority of you, I don't think so. So think about it. War on drugs. Wars just don't seem to work to me. But that's just me. So, the preceding program represented the opinions of producing participants and did not represent the views of WMRWLP or its license holder, Roots Work, or MRVTV.